Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Drunk Queer Bitches Talk Books.
I'm Tony, the nerdy one.
I'm Adam, the sassy one.
I'm Jared, the quirky one.
And I'm Erin, the lesbian.
In this episode, we'll be continuing our discussion of Consider Phlebas by Ian M. Banks. Just a quick reminder, we will be discussing the entire plot, so if you don't want anything spoiled for you, pause, read the book, come back, or you can read over our summary, which you can find on our WordPress page.
We're moving on now to a discussion of sentience.
And the reason we are now moving on to sentience was, as I was talking to the group about my opinions on the lesbian subtext, Adam asked a rather interesting question. Adam?
In our group chat, I was like, can a robot be a lesbian?
Which brings up the topic of conversation of sentience, assuming, do they have a gender? Do they have a sexual orientation, sexual preference? Like, because we said with, like, Unaha Clasp, the pronoun is always it, so... But that's just one machine. I don't know if that's...
Robosexual.
And I just, like, another thing that's a side note there. Like, it was really weird. Did anyone else notice that they said the Adirans, when they became warriors, they became genderless, but they kept referring to Zozarl and the other guy as males? And I was like, excuse me, should they not be genderless? Like, because they were like, he's a warrior male. And I'm like, the warriors are genderless. How is he a warrior male? Anyway.
Chop it right off.
No, like, apparently they're... genitalia, like, get absorbed by their bodies or whatever, and they become sexless.
Right.
That doesn't really, that's neither here nor there. I just wanted to bitch about that for a second.
You can bitch about that in the thing.
Did you have those on sentience? Because it sounded like you had a whole spiel.
I didn't really have a whole spiel. I just, it's interesting because I'm watching Battlestar Galactica right now with my boyfriend, and that's, like, a really big question, right? Like, the Cylons, they look like people, and I'm assuming there are probably, like, AI in this world that have been made to look like people. So, like, where is the line of, like, you are now a person, you are now in the same equal status as a person, you know, your life is just as valuable as this guy who was born.
And that definitely does play into the culture, because the culture has the drones, and if they call it the like a drone, it's kind of understood it is a conscious, sentient being that has its own feelings, because they have the aura fields to show their emotions.
Which Unaha Clasp actually, like, mentions at some point, right?
Yeah, he argues for it, because Horza is treating him like crap, and he's like, I have a name, I am, like, respected by the culture as a sentient individual.
That's when I really, really started to dislike Horza, is when he was, like, a total dick to Unaha Clasp. I was like, this is my favorite character. Step off.
Like, he felt,
I've known it for, like, 5 seconds, and it's already my favorite, so...
You're a speciesist asshole. Calm it down.
Like. I guess we had to get that, like, Horza had to treat a machine, even a conscious machine, like crap, because that is his thing. He's fighting for the Adirans, because the Adirans are against the machine-powered culture.
I mean, I got it, but it was kind of like...
It was still annoying.
Yeah.
No. You obviously weren't supposed to like it.
And then it brings up, like, the broader question, like, you know, at what point are these machines the same as humans? When do they have the same value as us?
And there is a gradient, because then, even in the whole of the culture, you have the humans, but above them you have the minds, which are supposed to be so much more powerful than humans. But then even at the same time, there are the referrers, because there's apparently just something in the quirk of human brains that... the machines can't quite get. And then you have, kind of on the same level as humans, maybe a little bit above, you have the drones, which are self-aware and conscious. And then there are, like, the drones that the minds use, which are just kind of robots that the minds control, which are essentially like an extension of themselves, like an appendage. And then you kind of go down that scale. Like, did anyone feel like the shuttle that he boards on the island was supposed to be sentient or not?
I think it was. It seemed like low grade, because it was like,
well,
old,
it did say it was
whatever.
Older, yeah.
So it was probably like so below cute. A drone, but...
It was, like, the most pleasant little shuttle, and I was really sad when he murdered it.
I know! When he killed the brain, I'm like, oh, Horza!
But he doesn't care about their lives.
You're such an ass.
Because he doesn't consider them.
Right.
I mean, he also did have a mission, so there's that, but...
So it's... I guess it kind of plays into that theme of the book, the humans versus the technology, or life in general versus the technology. Because Horza's arguing that life should win out, and that we should be creating technology like the minds that are so much more advanced, because eventually they might decide, well, why do we have all these humans around? And I think that's an interesting question in the context of the culture, because it's like the humans are just there for the heck of it. Like, why do these machines even consider the humans necessary anymore?
At that point, it's like the AI are more valuable, really, in terms of their life's worth than the humans.
Right.
So
the humans are just kind of there for flavoring.
Mm-hmm.
Like with that quote
I think
gave before.
I think the culture realizes that there's beauty in diversity, right?
Everybody has some sort of importance.
Yeah.
Everybody has something different that they can bring to the table.
Yeah. When you don't have to worry about an economy, you can...
Right.
Yeah. Don't even... You'll get me on a rant.
About what?
He said hashtag all lives matter.
Oh my God.
No. We're not even going down that route. Because all lives matter is a very racist movement.
Most of the story is told from Horace's point of view. It's third person, but we're kind of in his head. And for the vast majority of the story, that's how it is. You get the little cut scenes over to Thal, and you get Thal's point of view just for her little bits. And then I actually like that he did this when, like we said, it was kind of like episodic. And at the end of each episode, there would be this short little scene that was totally third person omniscient, where we're like outside the ship and you're seeing something getting jettisoned from the ship, or you're seeing like something happen that no one else is really paying attention to. So I thought that was a cool way for him to kind of put the credit sequence at the end of each episode.
Yeah, it was interesting how much it was like a TV show in that regard, I guess. Because there were moments, like, I didn't, like, call many of them out, but there were times when, like, he would, within a chapter, not even just at the end, he would kind of shift and you'd hear, like, a bit of another character's thought. And it was a little jarring at times. Like, oh, this is in the same paragraph where we were focusing on Horza.
Especially at the end of the book.
I mean, in fairness, at the end, he did start, he put gaps in between, like, an extra space. So it was like, oh, we're going...
And it became still very erratic, kind of going, like, back
and it was pretty erratic. It became really obvious, though, like, oh, now we're going back to the train, like, after a while.
You knew from context what it was talking about.
And it was definitely, like, I think jumping like that definitely to build the action, because that's the climax.
I understand why, but it still annoyed me.
And also at the same time...
That's a personal feeling, of course.
At the same time, you can also tell he's doing that, spoiler warning, because something might be about to happen to our main character, point of view character.
So, yeah. That's a good point. So then he was, like, kind of building so that when it obviously necessarily has to go to another character's point of view, you're not quite what's happening? Like, what? But yeah, I agree, the climax went on.
Kind
of a bit too long.
Yeah. They could have trimmed it, we get what's happening. Come on.
Right.
we get the gist of the story. Like, it was really at the end that my
intense,
eyes were just like, okay, this big thing happened. Don't care about the details. This big thing happened.
We might want to cut out the bits where we obviously didn't do our homework.
Like, it's again kind of a question, like, what did people make of that theme? Because it became pretty clear, as I said earlier, like, during the damage game where Craiglin's emotions overwhelmed him, and then he was like, oh no, like, am I Craiglin, am I myself? It was like, oh, so he doesn't really, like, know what his deal is. And there's, like, other points in the book, like, obviously when he dies and he's like, he doesn't have an appearance anymore, like, oh, who was he? I think Fowl at one point is like, oh, the changer who doesn't know who he is or whatever. So they mention it a lot, and seeing as he's the main character, the only thing I can conclude is like, oh, so really the entire point of this book was his journey to find himself, or to, like, to make peace with his kind of ephemeral nature as a changer.
A question that brings up with Horza being a changer is, are you still yourself if you change so often? Do you keep a small piece of yourself? Do you get rid of that entirely and just become a changer? You don't have a self.
I think that's sort of what they were saying, is that he had changed so much that, like, he lost sight of who he was.
Which makes sense. Like, if you change yourself so often, how do you remember?
One little thing that stuck out to me was he changed himself back to, like, a base form for the crew, but then he said he mixed in a little bit of what the woman on Char's world was going to expect. So it's like there was this other form that he had on Char's world, but when he was still just Horza, like, he wasn't even an assumed identity back on Char's world when she would have known him. So it's like, was that his base form? Was he something different before he went into exile? So, like, what do we even consider to be base Horza?
Yeah, I thought that was telling, that he was just, like, a one-third, a form that a woman on Char's world would recognize. And I was like, so why was that not his base form? Like, why would he not say that if that were the case?
And then at the end, when, spoiler warning, when he does die...
I think they know this at this point.
When he does die, Balveda specifically mentions she looks on him and his face is very plain.
Mm-hmm. And then,
so
of
it's
course,
like everything else just melted away, I guess, when he was no longer trying to hold up the identities.
That but could it wasn't be significant, even... though, the way that she says that his face is plain, almost like a blank slate.
Right, exactly.
Running off of, oh, well,
so
there's nothing left.
So did he start as a blank slate then? Or did he that become actually, a blank slate?
I would like to think that he started that way.
Yeah, so maybe all changers do. I mean, it's not... It's possible that
see
all
adult
changers are exactly the same blank slates, and then...
They see adult changers who have assumed the forms of other people, and they're like, oh, I'll take some of that, I'll take some of that, like...
So, is it really Horza's blank slate persona, that, like, original persona that agrees with the Adirans and doesn't like the culture and has all these opinions that he does maintain throughout the book?
Or is that something that he picked up?
Something that he picked up, yeah, because... Their the Changer Society is now in the Adirans sphere. Mm-hmm. So if he's going to side with one of the sides, it makes sense that it's going to be the Adirans if he's just a blank slate when he starts out as a Changer.
It's true.
Could be an idea of self-preservation. Pick which side is winning and go from there.
Yeah.
Or which side you believe is going to win.
The,
we haven't read the rest of the series, so we have no idea. Yeah.
To the winner go the Changers.
Yeah, I felt a little cheated by his lack of reasoning, frankly. Like, he was like, oh, I just feel like the Adirans on the side of life. I'm like, what? Like,
what does that mean?
Did, like, what machine touched
you? He got a lot more specific.
Though, like...
He got more specific later on when he was like, here's the Adirans philosophy. Their god is essentially the concept of order. So they're trying to order the universe to please their god. And then he even, like, goes ahead. He's like, in 10,000 years, they're going to calm down and plateau. Mm-hmm. And then they'll still just be the living beings that use machines rather than the society of living beings that are controlled by their machines.
Mm-hmm.
So I like when he... It was kind of an aside that he's having in his own head while other things are happening, but he does, like, get more specific about why he's siding with the Adirans.
Yeah. He just seemed, like, really butthurt for not a good reason. Like, I don't know.
No, agreed.
I mean, no, when he's, like, talking to himself, he seems to be okay in his reasoning. When he's, like, just being an asshole to the drone, like, yeah, then he just sounds butthurt about machines in general.
Like the old man shaking his fist at like
the clown.
At the clown.
The clown. Oh yeah, yeah.
The Simpsons meme.
Oh.
Old man shouts at cloud.
Did that answer your question, Jared?
It did indeed.
Ooh, good.
All right, so now we have our best quotes or one-liners.
Okay, so I had a favorite quote. I don't know about anyone else.
And we were waiting in anticipation for this.
He would not tell us
what it was.
Would not tell us what it was. So we're all waiting for this.
We're all learning together, listener.
Okay, so... And
it better be good.
Shut up. Now I'm feeling nervous about it. It wasn't a Nunahak quote.
Should we end with his? Because mine aren't great, but I wanted to like...
I don't even have any, so...
I just have one.
So mine was not a Nunahak quote. Quote. It was a Yalson quote, and it was, I've been zapping this poor bitch every time she flicks an eyelid, and I want to know why I've been doing it.
Yes! That was amazing. Oh my god, I forgot about that one. That was great, though.
Good job, Adam.
So,
if I was, like, sitting on the plane when I'd heard that, I probably would have highlighted it, but I think I was in the gym at the time, so
okay.
I kind of glossed over it.
So there were, like, they kept stunning poor Balveda, like, and I was like, she's gonna get brain damage from this guy. It's like, at one point she has, like, that seizure kind of thing, and, like, she's dribbling spit, and then she's over here been zapping her every time she flicks an eyelid, and then there's a point where Horza, before Balveda reveals it as Horza, he's like, he opened his mouth to tell Yalson to stun her again, and then, like, he got distracted, and I was like, oh my god! So, it reminded me, obscure Harry Potter reference, of Bertha Jorkins from Harry Potter Goblet
of Fire.
And how, like, she was so, like, her mind was basically mush because she'd been memory charmed, right, so many times. So anyway.
That was
a really good line, yeah.
I laughed out loud when I read it. I was like, this is definitely going to be my favorite line in this book.
All right, Jared, what was yours?
Okay, so mine, because I am a huge nerd when it comes to things like Doctor Who, is my all-time favorite TV show. And I found one that actually was very similar to the Ninth Doctor's farewell speech. And the Ninth Doctor was my favorite of all of them so far. Look on the happy side. Think of the good things. Hadn't it been clever? Yes, it had. Which was just a kind of offhanded thought by a drone that was escaping at the time in Chapter 6. And it's just fun to think, like, the drone is escaping all of this, trying to get away from what's going on, and these random thoughts are just passing by. Kind of like humans. Random thoughts that come from nowhere.
Okay, I'm just looking at the things that I highlighted. I did like the one, I guess kids these days just can't tell their gravity from their rotating frame of reference. Kids these days.
I love kids these days quotes. Like, they're so fun.
And then there was when Fal and Jace were talking, said the General War Council itself decided that we should try to duplicate the feat using a similar mind and a spare planet. What happened? Fal asked, grinning at the idea of a spare planet.
I did have a spare planet. We have a couple of them just floating around.
Floating around out there.
I did have one more that I liked. That was Zozarl said it when he was relaying the tale of how they trekked 200 miles. I walked 200 miles in the snow to get to this command system. Damn it!
It was very much like that, wasn't it?
I walked to school in the snow, uphill both ways.
I worked hard for this damn mine, so it's mine. So he says, in the air, or in that air, when you cried, tears froze on your face with a cracking sound, like a heart breaking. And I was like, ooh, yeah. I thought it was kind of like very romantic for such a kind of fanatical species.
Right.
Anyway, anyone else have any quotes or good lines? Besides everything that Unha Kloss said.
All of his dialogue, yeah.
Yeah, special shout out to his, I think Tony mentioned it earlier, his, I have a creation debt, blah, blah, blah. And then Yalsin does have another good line where she's like, are you sure you're not majoring in law, drone?
Oh yeah, my favorite bit with him was when Horza is in the middle of a sentence. He's like, I hope you're well insured.
The feminism section is going to be me and Adam ranting about Yalsin's pregnancy, but yep. So get prepared, y'all.
Tony and I keep them at arm's length away from each other.
Okay,
are we not in agreement?
No, Adam and I are in total agreement on it.
I was about to say, I thought we were on the same side here.
Adam and I are 100% in agreement, and that is,
we'll protect any man who walks into the room.
Was it necessary? And the answer is no.
No.
No, it fucking wasn't.
It didn't add anything to the plot besides, okay, it was basically, and I love soap operas, everyone who knows me knows, but it was a soapy twist designed to when she died, she's pregnant, how sad.
Are you reading off my notes, Adam? Because literally I have written, it didn't seem to add anything to the story other than Horza avenging her death, leading to his death.
Yeah.
So basically as you started talking, I was like, yep, this is it.
I will say, and this isn't really, really defending the thing, but I got a bit of, perverse glee out of the fact, that old quote about revenge, digging two graves before you set out to do it. So not only did you actually, so none of that shit would have happened if they hadn't killed Zozarl in the beginning. So he was trying to avenge Kirishel, which led to Zozarl coming with them, which basically led to them getting trapped on the train, because they would have had enough time to get out and be safe if he hadn't been shooting at them, which, of course, led to Yalsin's death, and Horza. Well, then when he tried to avenge Yalsin, then he died. And anyway.
It's a whole thing. Although I was really fascinated about how easy it is to have an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Because she basically says, if you don't, if you don't want this, if you think I should end it, I can just think about it and it'll be done. Which I kind of like, because it is the ultimate woman's choice at that point.
Yeah.
You literally have to consult no one other than yourself.
True,
you don't have to involve anybody other than yourself. You're just like, I don't want this, gone.
Ironically, she defers to him, which I knew, I felt like you were going to,
to have something to say about. Irritated.
Okay, so I always have really mixed feelings on that, because I feel like while it is ultimately the woman's choice, sometimes it is still probably a good idea to talk to the other person involved in it. If they eventually get to, is like, oh no, 100%, you were gonna have this baby. Then you can be like, okay, no, fuck you. But I don't know. It's always a weird argument when it comes to that. Because he is part of it.
I totally see what you're saying. I guess my irritation with it was she was almost simpering when she went to him. She's like, if you don't want
it
me to have
she
it.
Did. It wasn't so much that she did it. It was how she did it.
She was
it.
The neediest, don't leave me. I'll abort the baby if you want me to, or I'll keep it. I don't care.
She didn't go and be like, look, here's what's happening. I'm kind of on the fence about whether I want to keep it or abort it. What is your opinion? Yeah.
So it was just that. And then when he was so patronizing with her, the rest of the book.
I have a quote.
Again, they would not have all died if he hadn't been there for 20 minutes, being like, oh, you can't come down because you're pregnant.
Okay, so I did actually write one of these quotes because as soon as he said it, if you go into my notebook, my note is literally, I just wrote down the location that I found it, and it's just really in all capital letters with a question mark and an exclamation point after it because I was so irritated. He says to her, "You're imagining things. Your hormones are getting the better of you, developing suspicions in second sight." And I was like, "You shut your fucking mouth." You are such a patronizing asshole. Like, which I don't know if the author was trying to make like some sort of commentary on the really dickish things that men say to pregnant women, or like, I don't know what the thought plan on that was, but oh, I was so irritated. I was like,
Yeah. Oh yeah, I highlighted the same thing and I said, "Wow, really?" Yeah. And then later on, Yalson, like in the next little sentence, Yalson looked unconvinced, and I was like, "Agreed." Like, because he's like, "Oh, I was like, joking."
Actually, that's the next part of my notes, followed by a "just joking." But was he really?
Yeah.
Like I said, Adam and I are 100% on the same page with this. Like, to the same note.
We did not even, we swear we did not talk about the feminism angle at all beforehand. Like,
that's the kind of, like, little nitty-gritty that you don't catch when you're listening to the audiobook at 1.30 speed.
Oh my god, Tony. You're ridiculous.
That was my big rant about feminism was her pregnancy. But there are a couple other little things.
I wouldn't say it was the most feminist book.
But like, it wasn't the most anti-feminist book either.
There were just a lot of sexist characters. Because
you got, like,
Helvetia
being an SE agent. It's understood that she's, like, a strong character, even if she doesn't spend all of the book in bonds.
I mean, most of the female characters were, like, not pathetic or anything.
Right.
Like, Yalson, like, a lot of the times I was cheering her on because she was the only one that would, like, stand up to people like Craiglin and Horza and be like, no, this is bullshit. Or I demand an explanation on why we're doing this. Yeah. Like, yeah.
That's why the pregnancy thing was so frustrating.
Because she was such a strong character. And then they brought this pregnancy thing in, and I'm just like, but why? What is the point of this?
Yeah.
The night before I listened to that part in the audiobook, you guys were there and talking about, like, oh, this thing that happens with Yelson's character. I'm like, oh boy, what's coming up? And they're like, well, we're not going to spoil it for you, but there's this thing that happens with her character.
And it's really irritating.
And then, like, I'm listening to it that night, and it gets to the point where, like, I'm pregnant. I'm like, oh god.
Yeah, so that we did discuss that part, but we didn't even say the word pregnancy. We didn't. Yeah.
No, they didn't tell me what the tragedy was. Yeah. That how her character turns out.
The really funny thing was, like, the minute I was like, I really want to talk about something that happened with Yalson, Adam immediately knew what I was referring to. He's like, oh, yeah. Me too.
I mean, as soon as it came up, I'm like, oh, that's what they were none too happy about.
Yeah. It's not even that they, like, I mean, like, sure, they killed her off, whatever, and she was pregnant. It was, yeah. And they had to go through all these hoops, like, cross species, pregnancy shouldn't be possible, but I'm culture, blah,
although
blah.
It was kind of, like, I did really wonder why she kept asking about radiation so much, and then, like, when that was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense.
I made a note of
that. Okay, I gotcha. Because, like, it was, like, really, it was that kind of weird foreshadowing where you know it's foreshadowing for something because you're just like, this makes no sense. Why is she asking? Mm. But, yeah, I think in general, like, the female characters were, like you said, it wasn't the most feminist book. It wasn't the most anti-feminist book. It was just kind of a book written by a man in the 80s. Like,
yeah. Right. Yeah. A sad, like, amount of, yeah.
By a liberal man in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, but
there was just a lot of casual sexism, basically. Yeah.
Which has been in the, you know, we've been working on getting rid of some of that casual sexism in the years since then. So, like you said earlier, if he was writing it in this day and age, it probably wouldn't be quite as.
Right.
What did you, I'm curious about you guys' opinions. Like, did you have the same reaction that we did? Like, because we read all the feminist websites and whatnot, yeah. So we're, like, primed to be outraged.
So, I mean, I was already biased
angry
by the fact that you guys.
Angry feminist ranting is one of my, like, fortes, guys. So.
My reaction to it, I feel like, was biased by the fact that you guys had already ranted about it. Like, I don't know if I would have overthought it if I just listened to it in isolation. But as soon as I heard the I'm pregnant, I'm like, oh, this is what they were saying was problematic, and yeah.
So you think maybe if we hadn't said something, you wouldn't have.
I mean, like, during the discussion, I totally would have been on the same page as you guys, but I probably wouldn't. It would have been a red flag with me, necessarily. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it might
have. Yeah, Adam and I really look into all that stuff, so.
And with me, I spend a lot of my time when I'm reading anything so focused on both sides of the argument that I kind of become desensitized to it, where I just kind of go against everything with a, well, maybe she had a reason for having the discussion instead of just just being like, well, I don't like it, gone.
I think she did have a reason. Like I said, it wasn't the fact that she did it. Right. I understood why she talked to him about it. My thing was, why did she have to do it like that?
Yeah. Right. I feel like the fact that she deferred to him was like, I will do what you want me to do with this baby. I feel like I would have eye-rolled at that. Yeah. I might not have.
I'm surprised my eyes aren't still in the back of my head from how much I was.
Yeah, like, I don't know that I would have, like, sat down and wrote a feminist rant about it. But I probably would have eye rolled if
leave that to
if,
us.
There was some rage highlighting going on.
Like I said, I just wrote really. I'm pretty sure like it's the most indented page of my notebook was when I was writing that. Luckily, I was like by myself while I was reading, and I wasn't scaring off like Cheryl or anything as I was.
Here's feverish scribblings for the other. What is going on in there? Oh, she's just reading this really terrible, shitty part in a book.
Angry feminist ranting. One of the qualifications to be a lesbian, so.
Okay, so the next thing on the agenda to discuss is the writing style. So the one real comment I had that I jotted down just in the beginning was, I'm in chapter one, and the first thing I notice is that the language is so elegant, I find I can continue eating my lunch, even as the narrator describes a man being drowned in sewage.
Okay, I do want to ask why every single punishment in this book is so friggin' disgusting. It always has something to do with, like, shit or, like... There was always some sort of excrement happening during punishments. Is it just because it's something that is universally disgusting? Like, yeah, is that one? Yeah, it doesn't matter who you are. That sounds awful. Maybe that's why.
I think so.
But I was just like... Because I remember reading that, and I was like, if this is what the rest of this book is going to be like, I don't know how I'm going to go. Like, I don't know if I can do this.
I thought it was disgustingly clever.
Oh, no, it was definitely a super clever punishment. I found myself going... Oh, that's actually, how have we not thought of this before? That's a really good idea. But at the same time, it was like...
been done at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely a way to, like, for him to make it visceral.
I agree, and there was a lot of, like, visceralness?
Viscerality, yeah.
Like, the beginning of, like, that whole thing with Fui Song was...
That was disgusting. Ugh.
And he kept describing how disgusting everything they were wafting under his nose was.
Which I think is a sign that he's a pretty good writer when you can be that visceral. Because, like, some of the fighting, I was like, this is getting to be a lot. Like, especially at the end when he, like, when Zozaro was, like, fighting down and dirty with Horza, I was like, this is getting intense. Like,
I don't really think it's a... I'm not, like, criticizing the writing style. I think it's a good writing style. Yeah, it's just maybe
almost
not...
too much.
Maybe not my kind of writing style.
Blood's about to seep out of the pages.
Yeah, I'm just like...
So that's, like, if this guy didn't write screenplays and like direct things, he should have, because he's got a very good like visual vocabulary.
Yeah, it does.
And that's, I guess that's why we're reading this, is because I read the other one in the series and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the concepts and I enjoyed the language and I enjoyed the way that he would let his characters go on rants sometimes. I liked it, and I thought if we read another one that I hadn't read yet, just the writing itself might be something that we'd all enjoy, even if it's not everyone's cup of tea genre-wise.
Yeah, I mean, I overall, like, I was very impressed with like all the imagery and how much thought he put into,
there's
like...
There's a lot of description and world building.
Yeah, so much world building.
Yeah.
And I, like, if I heard one more, like, measurement in that book, I was about to scream, because, like, I mean, I was so impressed, but I was like, this is 1,000 meters, imagine 10,000 suns, blah, blah, blah. I was like, my God, I don't know, my brain can't handle this. Just tell me it's a room.
With a lot of shit in it.
Which I kind of did in my mental imagery anyway.
Yeah, I mean, he was creating scale.
Yeah, he was. It was just, it was a lot.
Which is something that's really important for writers if you're building an entire world from fiction. Like, for other writers, if you're basing it off of our galaxy, like, people at least have a basic idea and concept of it. But if you're creating an entire existence, you have to go in and be like, this is how far away things are. There are so many planets that there are extra throwaway planets that you can just do whatever with. Blow them up, it doesn't matter.
The Douglas Adams quote, space is big. Really, really big. It's impossible to imagine just how incredibly big space is.
See, I would prefer that.
Yeah. Well, but he was writing comedy.
I don't care. I'd still prefer that.
That's Hitchhiker's Guide. It was specifically meant to be funny.
I wanted like a glossary of some of the sci-fi terms.
And
like,
also a pronunciation guide would have been nice.
Because that's what I was hoping when I saw, when I kind of like part way through the book, I saw that there was a glossary. I was like, ooh, maybe like it'll be, no. And there was like, there were some words that were very specific to this world that like GSV that he like dropped and then he explained later. But then there were some kind of like sci-fi-y terms that like just never received any explanation. Like hyperspace, which obviously people know hyperspace, but things in that kind of.
For me, I think the problem was my main type of reading that I do is young adult fiction. And when you are talking to a younger audience, you have to do a lot more exposition and explanation than you do when you're talking to adults. So I think I'm just spoiled by the books that I read that go into a lot. Like, if there's, I read a lot of fantasy. So if there's like a species that's part of that fantasy world that's not part of our world, it gets an explanation because the author is talking to teenagers normally, like so. Maybe I think that was just like I'm just not used to books like dropping terms that I don't know, and then just not doing anything with them, and I'm just like.
But what was frustrating about it is that he would eventually explain most of the terms, but in his own good time.
Yeah,
it was like, I mean, if you're just gonna do this blatant exposition anyway,
just do it like, when you drop it. Yeah,
I guess that just didn't get flagged with me just because I read the science fiction, and
that was another thing. Like, that's your thing that you usually... It's really hard to kind of read against your own type a little bit sometimes. And that might be why.
That's what the plot of all of this is, to get us all out of it.
Yeah.
For, I don't know about you specifically, you haven't weighed in on this, but I know at least for me and also for Aaron, this one was like way out of my comfort zone.
Oh, yeah.
The only book I've ever really read in the sci-fi genre and enjoyed was Ender's Game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read the
Ender's... This was actually my first legit science fiction novel.
Mm. I've read...
I read, like, a lot of sci-fi fantasy, but that's a very broad category, so what I read is mostly the fantasy side of it, like dragons and wizards and that kind of stuff, not so much the...
I did also read iRobot.
Yeah, I read more fantasy, and I've read some science fiction. I've read the mainline Ender books, the four of those. But that's a very different style than this.
Yeah. I mean, that's not really space opera so much. That's military.
Yeah. And then I've also, I watch sci-fi on TV, but, like, the language is a little different for me, certainly.
Which is weird, because I watch a decent amount of, like, sci-fi-ish television. I don't know, I guess there's a difference between watching something on TV and reading it in a book, but...
Aaron is no longer a sci-fi virgin.
Woo!
I jot down observations that I had in regards to religion in this story. The culture itself appears to be largely atheist and secular, but religions do emerge from it, which I thought was interesting. Like, the Eaters, they all seem to come out of the culture society, and they just seem to, like, reject the whole idea of having galactic civilization. Like, some of them didn't even seem to think the universe was real beyond their own scope. So that seems strange. Like, these people seem to have come out of this galactic civilization, but rejected its very existence and formed this bizarre cult of personality around Fuisong. I thought it was interesting that all the religions in the book appear to be variations on monotheism. They all made a reference, like, anytime religion was discussed, they always made a reference to God, capital letter God, which is, that seems strange to me because I feel like that's not the default religion for humans, humanesques. Yeah, there are, like, you know, they have the three main monotheisms in our world, but then, or in our reality, but then you also have, you know, almost anything else is going to be something else. So I'm going to have polytheism or like ancestor worship, something like that that's not necessarily a monotheistic with a central god. So I thought it was interesting that almost every religion that was brought up, it seemed to be centered around a singular god.
Well, it could be a lot of things like how different polytheistic religions work in real life, where they kind of hide behind the monotheistic religions because they fear persecution. It could be that they exist in this world or just not brought up.
That's a point. But even in like fringe stuff though, like the one girl who was religious on the ship believed in a singular god, and the Eaters believed in a singular god when they could have been anything. They were rejecting the culture as a whole anyway.
Yeah, it might have just been like an expediency thing, or maybe he was trying to make some statement.
It was just an interesting observation, I thought.
Because very, very easily Dorilau could have been like, oh, you know, she could have been like, oh, sweet Shiva or whatever, you know, like some made up sci-fi name, and she could have just substituted.
Isn't Shiva a real god?
Well, yeah, I just mean
I was gonna say cut that out.
I couldn't make up one, so I
you
just
could have just
say
a random word.
Well, whatever, blorp. Oh sweet, blorp.
The problem was like you said the name, and they were like, oh, so you're gonna reference that particular god, and then you said, or you know, something made up. I was like, but
that's
not
a real.
Made up. It's a real.
I anyway, so I think it would have been very easy for her to just list
Yes, all our Hindu listeners.
Hey, I mean, my brother-in-law's family might listen to this, so you know.
Okay, fair, fair.
They probably won't, but they could. Anyway,
from an elderly listenership.
Back to Juliana. Okay, so I also jotted down the Adiran religion. I thought was interesting because it had nothing to do with immortality. Because
they already are immortal.
Yeah, they're already biologically immortal. The idea of immortal souls is laughable to them. They, like, guffaw at Horza when he asks them if they believe in a soul. So their whole religion, rather than being centered around immortality, trying to achieve immortality, like most of the we are familiar with, it seems it's more centered around that concept of order in the universe. They believe that they are on a mission from God to bring the universe to order, to make God happy. And so their conquest of the universe in God's name is centered around that idea of imposing their idea of order onto it. And that's why they clash with the culture, because the culture is very ambiguous and disordered and atheistic. But then that seems to get subverted in the appendix, because the appendix first line is basically an admission. The appendix reads like a confessional that the culture's principles are basically a religion in their own right. Because the very first line of the appendix says the reason for the culture was primarily religious. And I'm thinking, oh yeah, they're fighting the Adirans. But then as it continues, it's like, it's basically describing their belief that they can benevolently interfere with all these other races as being their religion. And that their religious idea that they can do that was threatened by the existence of the Adirans.
I mean, I think that could be said about any kind of thing like that.
Like any concept can be, any ideology can be taken to a religious extreme. Because I wanted to phrase that as a question, actually, because I'm big into atheist and secular culture, as I listen to a lot of podcasts, a lot of YouTube videos, whatnot. One thing that you get a lot is that religious people will accuse atheists of being a religion in itself. And everyone's like, no, not stamp collecting isn't a hobby. Bald isn't a type of haircut. Like, not believing in a god or any religious ideology isn't a religion in itself. But it did seem kind of to imply that the culture became a religious society because they had to adopt something. Mm-hmm. So I guess I wanted to say, like, do intelligent sentient beings need to have a religion of some kind? Even if it's an atheistic religion that they have to believe in their own ability to better the universe, like the culture seems to.
Yeah, like, religion is basically just, like, what, rituals and a belief in something greater than yourself, even if it's not, like, a deity, but that there's some kind of order out there or what have you. So in that regard, I think if you really want to get down to it like that, and I'm an atheist myself as well, but, like, I guess you could say that it's a religion if you want to be really picky. Like, you know, we have holidays here, and some of them have no real religious basis, but we still celebrate them, like, rituals. So, like, is America a religion in a way? Hmm.
America is Christian. I don't know what you're talking about. Sorry. That was a whole other rant. Oh
my God. I kind of get what you're saying. Like, my take would be that an atheist society, by definition, isn't religious, but they can adopt the trappings of religion. Like, they can have ritual, they can have ideas that they get behind and that they believe in. I mean, if they're being good skeptics, hopefully they'll be prepared to abandon those ideas if evidence shows that they're not the best way to proceed. So they're treating their idea that what's behind their entire existence, this need to improve the universe in their own interfering way, like a religion, even if they're not religious themselves. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see what he's saying, but yeah, I don't think that makes a religion. I was playing devil's advocate with my argument, but I don't know that I really agree with that. I think that's something else. I think there was an element in this book, certainly, of, like, being too, like, of fanaticism and zealousness. You know, like, cautionary tales, because, like, Horza becomes so devoted to his cause that, of course, it costs him his life. The Adirans, they end up losing the war because they refuse to compromise on their religious beliefs.
And yeah, like, Horza won't even, like, he's presented a intelligent machine that is essentially, that it is a sentient being.
Yeah,
and he still won't accept it. He's committed to the idea that, even though he's not religious himself, he's committed to this ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Take the concepts and the plot and try to apply them to current events. And by current events, I would say we could make that, like, current events for our time and current events for the time it's written. Because my first thought when I was reading the other novel, in the other novel, it's set from the point of view of a special circumstances agent who is going into these other societies and interfering on their behalf and trying to move those societies towards something that the culture wants to interact with and officially contact. I definitely got the idea that when he's writing this story, in his mind, the culture is very much Western society. At least in the third one that I read before, the culture was Western society, and then there were these smaller societies, which are going to be more like your African countries, your Middle Eastern countries, these other countries that at least very liberal people would generally agree are...
They're shitholes.
I was going to say...
Quote our president.
Yeah, that's definitely topical. I mean, I was just going to say that these countries often, it's to their detriment that we interfere with them. And these books were written long before you had, you know, endless Middle Eastern wars that America is...
Perpetuating,
yeah, and involving itself in. So I feel like it was a little bit prescient in that fact that he wrote this, and then it does, I mean, I'm sure there was something equivalent going on at the time, because, I mean, when this was written, you're in the middle of the Cold War, so he's probably got in his head superpowers that are fighting proxy wars in these smaller countries. So I definitely feel like that influenced his writing of the culture mythos. This idea that you have these superpowers that are both interfering with these other countries in their own way. And so suddenly you have North and South Korea on two different ends of a spectrum because they were influenced by these larger countries that are clashing.
I guess I had like a cynicism about it because I was like, at least the culture's trying to be benevolent in their interference. Whereas like, you know, Western society usually doesn't like, oh, they're not going to enlighten the natives. That's what they say. But they're really doing
that's
it
the,
so they can...
the rationalization.
Yeah, they're doing it so they can exploit them for resources. I wanted to get this analogy in somewhere, and I guess this is as good a place as any. I like saw the Adirans as like kind of like crusaders on steroids, you know? And it seemed like the culture was basically like white saviors, you know, like invading cultures without really understanding them and be like, I can help.
I can fix
says every
this
white
for
lady
you
ever
to make
like,
it.
Oh yeah.
Fit what I think it should be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true.
So yeah, like you said, I guess we kind of touched on it, but like the idea of these shithole countries, we assume we know what their conditions are like, and then
like we can
leader make- calls them such, and suddenly everyone's like, hold up, what do you actually know about these places?
These places that we didn't give a thought about yesterday, now everybody's like, oh, well.
Now this is the latest flashpoint in the debate. Like,
right.
Like Vavetch almost, like Haiti or El Salvador or what have you, they're like Vavetch, right? Like they're caught in the middle of this war between two ideologies.
Or the Changer asteroid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the Changers are being exploited by the Adirans, and they just happened to be in the sphere of Adiran influence when the war broke out.
I guess it's a universal theme, right?
So. It makes me think of, like, atolls where they're launching nuclear bombs, and, like, the natives have to be evacuated, and they don't even know why, and they're setting up cargo cults because there's this enormous war going on around them that they didn't ask to be a part of.
Cargo cults? What are cargo cults?
It's like the Pacific Islands where the military would move in during World War II and set up camp, and then suddenly the natives are seeing all this crazy technology that they've never seen before. And like even after the war ended and they pulled out, the natives actually go through these rituals that they believe will bring the cargo back.
Aww. That actually sounds really sad.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that's even worse. Like you're exposing them to like all
things
this
that can make their lives better, and then you just
take it
all
away
with you when you're done using their resources and their land for your needs. Yeah,
it's used by like sociologists today to show like see how easy it is for religions to pop up just because people don't understand what's happening.
It's definitely a common theme in sci-fi.
Very true. Yeah, you got Clark's. I think it's Clark's second law that any sufficiently advanced technology is equivalent to magic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get like the ancient aliens idea, because oh, these gods, they must have been aliens that people didn't understand what they were seeing.
I'm going to be a mega geek here and mention the JRPG series Star Ocean, which is typically about these like advanced societies going to like for all intents and purposes like medieval fantasy worlds. They usually have their own form of magic, but you know, they come with like these laser guns and teleportation devices and that kind of thing and blow the minds of the underdeveloped planets, as they call them.
So the next section after that, we just want to have a discussion of the genre as a whole. So, or how, I guess, how this story relates to the genre that it's a part of that we selected. So we just said we were going to do, to start, we were going to do a science fiction. And because science fiction is a bit more nuanced than my friends think it is, I asked them to narrow it down a little bit. So I asked them, do you want to do a cyberpunk? Do you want to do a space opera? And they decided on space opera. So this is the book that I pulled out for us to read. Relating it to science fiction as a whole, I definitely saw a lot of similarities between this and other science fictions that I've read. The Free Company is a lot like the Ultras in Alistair Reynolds' Revelation Space series. You got the Vavatch is a ring, which of course is a lot like Larry Niven and the known space universe and the ring world.
So to interject, I was very confused about how they described Vavatch. I mean, it was an orbital, right? So when they described it, I was like, so it's just basically a flat...
What's a ring? Yeah.
How is it a ring? It's like, literally...
Like it's a strip that's looped around. Like so they're living on the inside because it's spinning.
I guess I don't get it. Like how is there so much space in a ring? Like, it's a thick ring.
Then. Because really it's enormous, thick. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's described as even, like, wider, I think, than the width of a planet. So there's, like, even more surface area on it than a planet would be.
Well, you guys should probably edit that in the synopsis, because I just thought it was a flat planet. Like, literally just, like, a planet, but laid out 2D.
You've been listening to too much of the flat Earthers society. Talking.
I guess.
First off, where do you even think gravity came from in that scenario, then?
Huh?
Well, I guess they have artificial gravity.
Yes, so they have artificial just been gravity. I was just, like, they were talking up. About spinning, so I thought it was, like, a dish that was just spinning. Like, I don't know.
Now I'm just imagining that.
Yeah, because the lie is it's this circle that's spinning, and that's why there's gravity, because they're being pulled away from the center.
Yeah, so I thought it was a plate. It seemed a lot easier to get your head around than this ring thing, but whatever. So somebody needs to change that in the synopsis.
I guess it was easier for me to get my head around because I've read Ringworld, which goes into a lot of detail about a ring planet.
Okay, sorry, continue.
And so that's a trope in science fiction is the ring world or the... Because you have that in, like, Halo, too. The Halo worlds are that spinning ring.
I'm not that nerdy.
That's to your detriment.
For that topic. You're not that nerdy for that topic.
Yes. I literally just mentioned a JRPG sci-fi series, so.
There are definitely similarities with these other fictional universes. I have always enjoyed universes that are like a big universe where you can tell a bunch of different little stories in it like this. So like I was able to read one person's story in the third book. We read someone's completely a different story, but there are overarching themes, like the idea of the culture. And then we were all comparing it to a different science fiction television series. My mind definitely went to Star Trek, especially considering it would have taken place, like this was written 15 years or so after Star Trek, the first series would have premiered. But it would have been written before, a little bit before the Next Gen series would have premiered. So Star Trek would have been culturally significant, but it wouldn't have become the large franchise it is today. He specifically calls their method of travel warp drive. The culture's principles are very similar to the United Federation of Planets in that it's this utopian socialism, but the United Federation of Planets is much more lawful. There's specific worlds that are part. You either are a part of the Federation or you're not. And that doesn't seem to be quite the case with this because Banks himself has actually described the culture as fading out at its edges. What is the culture, what is not, is a bit more ambiguous than with other science fiction and other civilizations that are described. What's the ship name?
Enterprise?
No, the one in the
Clear Air Turbulence.
Clear Air Turbulence. I couldn't remember what the C was. I wrote Cat, but I didn't just want to say the Cat. Okay, so the Cat crew seemed to die off like red shirts.
True.
So that was very Star Trek-like. The utopia of the story, the culture, faces an outside threat, much like the Federation does in Star Trek, like with the Klingons or the Borg or the Dominion. The bad guys are the ones that are the least like human beings, which is also very Star Trek. Like, the Klingons start out as the bad guys, and they're the ones they make the least like the rest of the characters. And then you get, like, the Borg or the Dominion. The characters that are supposed to be the bad guys in Star Trek are always the ones that are the least human-like. So you were comparing it to Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, just because, you know, BS...
Shove this mic down your damn
mouth. So you were comparing it to Battlestar Galactica because...
Just because BSG has, like, the Cylons versus humans, essentially. And the humans have good reason for hating the Cylons, but they treat them like they're machines, even though they look just like them and can even have cross-species, like, children. So, you know, like, at what point... are we sentient, as I said earlier, you know? So there are questions of sentience in it. There's these kind of, like, religion questions, because BSG has two opposing, like, a monotheistic and a polytheistic religion, actually.
I think it's interesting that you compared to Battlestar Galactica, because that didn't really occur to me, because you have the world of the culture, which it's like every planet has its own society, its own humanoid or something similar to society.
It's almost like the colonies.
Life is everywhere. Well, I'm saying it's kind of the opposite in my head, because in my head, the Battlestar Galactica universe is desolate. The only thing, like the few bastions of any life are the colonies, and somewhere out there is Earth. And so it's like, then there are no aliens to scribe, just because I didn't think of it that way, because the universes feel very different to me. But of course there are,
I was just thinking thematically. I wasn't thinking of actual universes.
Because I'm looking at the world building. And,
and I'm literally like watching it now. Like, is the other thing. So it's very salient.
And then with me, I just kind of connected on a very, very narrow strip because of the way that Forza changes. Forza changes.
Just keep saying Forza, that'd be funny.
He is a changer.
Forza is the portmanteau name for Horza and Thou.
Oh!
Also not sponsored by Forza.
Say, that was a ship we didn't get into.
That's because I literally just thought of it when
she
he
was
said
into
it. I was not into it, but he said Forza, and I was like...
No, I meant I think Fowl might have been it.
She never even knows what he looks like, but she was curious.
Yeah. But anyway...
Sorry, back to Juliana.
The way that Horza was a changer and the way that it was an integration into society for his idea of a greater good, even if he necessarily wasn't right, is very Doctor Who-esque, where you have a main central character who does go through changes, in that case regenerations, and things that the main character believes are correct can end up being extremely detrimental down the road. Spoiler alert, like when the Doctor comes in and saves a humanoid person on this desolate planet, which ends up becoming his main enemy and grows into Davros, because he thinks, why did this good person who was so nice to me leave? Why did he take, like we were talking about earlier, why did they come in and bring all of this beneficial stuff and then take all of it away? And that was my very narrow-minded...
How do you think it stacks up against, like, some of the... Because you've read a lot of sci-fi, right? So, like, how do you think it stacks up against, like, seminal works of science fiction?
Like I said, I can definitely see, like, parallels between it and others in that space opera-y 80s type, like the Larry Niven and whatnot. I enjoyed it. It was, I definitely want to read more in the series. I don't know that I would say I enjoyed it more than the other one. The other one, the structure bothered me a little bit, but I liked the concept and I liked the world he built. So I want to play in this world some more. I definitely want to read others. I'll probably try to look up some of the short stories, because I feel like since they'll be a bit more contained and a bit more focused.
We have to read the second book, because you've read 1 and 3.
Yeah, I read 1 and 3. So yeah, I do need to go read the second one.
Player of Games. Yeah. Oh, is it about damage? If it is, let me know, because I would read a book about damage.
I actually probably would.
Cool.
I don't know if that answered your question.
I guess I kind of just meant, like, how would you, like, do you think it's one of, like, an underrated gem in the sci-fi pantheon? Like, is it... I don't know how famous it is, really. Like in
well, apparently it's famous enough to have 30 YouTube.
Yeah, I've heard of him and I've heard of it before, so it's definitely relevant to the genre.
Adam hadn't even heard that part yet.
I did see it mentioned in a Kotaku article, I think, that I was reading. And I was like, oh hey, we're reading this next month. Other than that,
I think it's one of those that, like, nowadays when people talk about, like, could we someday build a ring orbital? People will be like, hey, Larry Niven and Ian M. Banks wrote about that in the 80s. So it's definitely, like, relevant to the genre and relevant to the pop culture. And I think the themes are applicable. Like, if not specifically from this novel, then from the culture series as a whole. I think the themes definitely carry over to a modern day. So I enjoy this novel and the other one, and I will probably enjoy the rest of them based on the world that he built, even if not necessarily for the structure of the story or the particular characters that he wrote in each novel.
Okay. Cool.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, that answered my question.
Okay, so now that we've broken down the book and beat it within an inch of its life, we're going to go around to just get final closing thoughts, your favorite, least favorite thing about the book, give us a star rating, and would you read other books by this author or in this series?
Okay, so my favorite thing about the book, I touched on a little bit earlier, is definitely Unaha Clasp. I really, really love that drone. Like, until it showed up, I was very meh about most of the things that were going on. And I was like, oh, something that adds a little humor and a little sassiness and isn't a total dick. I'm a big fan of this. So I'd say that's probably my favorite. All right, so my least favorite thing about it, I don't know if there's like a specific, something really specific that's my least favorite thing. I couldn't really find myself getting into it all that much. What are you fucking doing? You're being really...
really weird.
You're being really distracting. What's going on?
We were both trying to be like, the pregnancy? Was that what was your least...
Okay.
Sorry, we were both trying to help you.
I was like, what are you doing?
We both just decided to grab our bellies at the same time.
My favorite and least favorite things are stuff we've already talked about, but okay. Mm-hmm. I mean,
is that okay?
I was just trying to like do something a little different, but if you guys are okay with being... So, my least favorite thing, I guess, would probably be the pregnancy, as I went on a little bit of a rant about that. I just felt like they took a kind of interesting, kind of fun, badass character and turned her into a trope. And I was not a soap opera trope at that. So I wasn't super thrilled about that. As far as star ratings, I gave it a 3.5 out of 5 because I thought it was well written. I thought like the plot was fun and it was, you know, kind of interesting, but it's just not my typical genre. And as for whether I would read another in the series, unless somebody else does and tells me like there's a really interesting character or a really interesting device in the rest of them, I probably would not read another one in the series. Again, no criticism to the author, just not my cup of tea.
Right, and it certainly wasn't mine either. Unless it is going to be something that we decide to do another book by the author, I certainly won't be continuing it. Mine would have to be a 2 out of 5 stars. I didn't particularly enjoy it. It wasn't the worst thing that I've ever read, but it's definitely not something that I would actively seek out reading. I did enjoy, though, that it gave a lot of things to think about, especially things to discuss on the podcast, where as other books, everything is kind of just inconsequential except for the main central plot. There are a lot of little tinier plots or other things going on other than just this plot that we can discuss on. The thing I like least about it would have to be the changing in pace back and forth, how it started really slow, things would speed up really quickly and go in 110%, and then back off again, and then go right back to where it was throughout the whole novel, especially when it hits the end and was just like, oh, you thought that those other things were kind of fast. Here's everything that's going to happen for the next X amount of years all at once. I didn't really enjoy the pacing of it very much. It could have been more hammered out.
So, I would say probably my favorite aspect of the book. I also really liked Uno and Klaus. I think my favorite bit was, like, how well he plotted out the final command system chapters and how the little chain that went on there, like, as annoying as it could get and as much as I was like, I really want you to hurry it up, it was a nice mastery of kind of, like, Pretty Little Liars style, putting all the pieces, like, in a nice little row.
Adam and I are big fans of Pretty Little Liars.
And then my least favorite aspect of the book, besides the pregnancy, would probably be just, like, the philosophical sections. Like, I know that the author was, like, probably trying to go for something really deep there, but, like, a lot of it went over my head, and it, like, became hard to read after a while. That's just my cup of tea. I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that love that stuff. As for a star rating, I'd give it, like, a 3 or 3.5, so I guess 3.25, if that's allowed.
It's our podcast. It's allowed.
And I would say that I would be open to reading another book by this author if he honed in on one of the aspects of this book that I found really engaging. Like, some of the things that we mentioned, I was like, oh, that'd be a cool spinoff or something along those lines. I found this book challenging because the protagonist was pretty unlikable, which is not a deal breaker, right? But it's weird when you're kind of reading outside your genre. Yeah.
Okay, so this is me reading inside my genre, so in that context, what I'd say is my favorite thing about the book would be what's always my favorite thing about science fiction, and it is the world building and the questions that it asks. Like, the questions that I sat down here and put out to you, I like when speculative fiction makes me ask those questions, the metaphysical, philosophical questions. Speculative things, like, can we build a ring that billions of people can live on the inside of? can we build faster than light travel, and could a super mind machine jump into the inside of a planet from a warp drive? And that's what I love about science fiction. I love learning about the world building. I love those little bits that other people, like, their eyes glaze over. I enjoy when we're talking to Fal, and Fal says there are 18 billion or 18 trillion people in the culture. That's the part that I get a little thrill. I'm like, oh, that's so fascinating. So I'm thinking about, how does a society that is that enormous function? Because it makes me ask questions. That's why I love those little bits. Can this culture exist on these rings? Can it build these technologies? Can it exist as a entity that's that large? That's what I did enjoy about this book, was those little bits. Now, my least favorite thing about this book is that I felt like it failed to focus on any of those and allow me to explore them. Every little thing that it touched on, other novels have touched on and done better. Like, the ring world concept is the whole point of reading the Known Space Universe by Larry Niven. Every other warp drive is explored in all sorts of other fiction. Thinking machines are explored in other things. And that was also the annoying thing about this book, is that I enjoyed other aspects of this universe more in the other book. Like, the idea of the sassy drones. That comes back. The drones are always the most interesting characters, at least I take it from the two books. The third one, the drones are the sassy, interesting characters, too, that I wanted to know more about. I just felt like this one did the least with what I enjoy most about science fiction. Now, I'm always very generous with book ratings, so I gave it a 3 out of 5, because I feel like this book is a component. As the first, he's honing his craft. It's a component of a larger universe which I would enjoy playing in and exploring more. So that does answer the next question, that I definitely will read more. I definitely do want to read the second one, the intervening novel between the two that I've read. And there's at least 10 that we're seeing on Goodreads, so I'll probably read more later on just to see. I'm very curious now to see how his later novels set in this universe play out. Like, does he explore more LGBT themes? Does he get better about his treatment of women? Less 80s, let's say, about his treatment of women. So I will definitely read more in this series, because I want to see how it plays out later on. And Jared just flashed us a...
Jared calculated an average of the four of us. So our average rating, if you round up, is a 3 out of 5.
2.9,
2.94.
As I said, if you round up...
So our topic and book of February is, take a wild guess, a trashy romance novel. Not that all romances are trashy, but we specifically wanted one, because that'd be fun. And we chose The Golden Barbarian by Iris Johansson. So, you know, start reading now, and join us on our journey through the fictional Arabia.
Our book this month was Consider Phlebas, and it was written by Ian M. Banks. We had a little bit of a question about the first name, because a lot of us looking at the word wanted to call it Lane M. Banks, because there's ambiguity about whether it was an L or an I. So it is an I, so it is II, so Ian M. Banks. And that is specifically the pseudonym he uses for all of his science fiction. So if you look up the name with the M in the middle, you should get all of those, the culture novels.
And I'll say that the reason it looks weird is because the physical version of the book has, like, a weird eye that looks kind of like an L, right?
Something like that, yeah. Oh, and even, like, on his other books, when I was reading the third one, I'm like, is this Lane or Ian? And so the book is available on the Audible and Kindle markets. If you want to look us up on social media, you can find us on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. It's all under the same username. It's DQB Talk Books, all just as one word. At DQB Talk Books. And our episodes and our blogs are available on WordPress, so you can find us there. And of course, from there will be links to all of our social media. You can find our WordPress at dqbtalkbooks.wordpress.com. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion of Consider Phlebas. Join us next time when we have
a new book,
new stories,
and most importantly, new drinks.
Until next time, and please read responsibly.
I guess when you look at religion at its very basic level, it's kind of like, it's made up of what, rituals and like a belief in something greater than yourself, whether that's a... I stopped talking when I did it. Get it.
Where is it?
It's behind you.
The entire podcast foiled by a gnat.
Anyway. What was I saying?
That's what I get for trying to pose a serious question.
Well, no, I mean...
It's the fucking gnat, I'm sorry.
It's like a big one. I'm